Five, four. Hello, and welcome to that 90s Wrestling Podcast. I'm your host, James Sunstone. Today, very special guest. He's one of the most creative minds in wrestling. He is the Zombie Princess, Jimmy Jacobs. How are you doing, Jimmy?
I'm doing fantastic. I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, great. It's a pleasure having you on. Started my show literally about 2 months ago, 2 or 3 months ago, and I've been shocked with the stars I've been able to get on. I've been working relationship with Impact Wrestling as well, and it's just been such a ride. And for someone like you, I've followed for many years. It's just, it's a pleasure having you on as well.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it just goes to show you that if you just, you can do whatever you want in this world, but you have to make the decision to do it, and then you have to attempt to do it. So, maybe 5 months ago, you thought, there's no way if I started a podcast, I'd be able to get this guy or this guy, or this guy. But then you realize, I'm just going to start the podcast and see what happens, and then reach out to this person and see what happens. The worst that can happen is they say no, which is, I already on my podcast before. So if they say no, it's the same thing as doing nothing. That's the worst case scenario is be exactly where you're at. So, it's a lesson from the universe that says, hey, I'll provide for you, but you gotta make the effort, do some of the work.
Cool, that's great. And because the reason I started my show was because of COVID, and I'm self-employed, I'm a builder, and I was basically said, right, you're gonna have to stay home for 2 months. And I've been meaning to start this channel for a while, so I thought, well, while I'm in lockdown, I might as well start one. And I'm enjoying it. I really am.
Yeah, that's the the flip side to everything that our planet has gone through over the last 6 months or so is that it's provided people with extra time, with opportunities to do things they might not have done otherwise. Myself included. Being in sort of isolation for months on end, it's like you have the choice to either collapse into yourself or go, okay, this is now a gift. I can look at. We have the privilege of looking at anything we want with whatever lens we want. And so you can sit here and say, everything that's going on is bad. Oh no, the world's ending. Oh no, oh no, no. Or you can say, okay, things aren't how I prefer them to be, but what can I do with this situation that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise? And that's what you're doing. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. So we'll go to the beginning then. Ask this everyone, your childhood, I presume you was a fan of wrestling growing up?
I was, yeah. My older brother was a fan. I have one older brother who's 3 years older than me. He was a fan. And just like when you're, when you're a younger brother, I guess you're a fan of what your older brother is a fan of.
Yeah.
So my first memory of wrestling is at my grandma's house watching Mr. Perfect shoot a perfect game of pool. And I think that was 89.
Cool. And I noticed as you was growing up in that, what made you decide to become a wrestler or be part of it? Because I noticed that you started off in the company Pro Wrestling Worldwide, but you was actually an assistant. So how was it working as an assistant, eventually becoming training?
It's a similar story. Is that my brother wanted to be a pro wrestler. He wanted to be a pro wrestler before I did, with more passion than me. When I was young, I was, I was good at math. I was a smart kid, a shy boy. And my brother, from the age of 6 or 7, wanted to be a pro wrestler. He asked my dad, why do I need to learn how to read? And why do I need to learn how to do math? Wrestler. My dad goes, so someday, son, you can read your pro wrestling contract and the amount of money they're paying you. The irony is my brother's now a math professor. He has his PhD university, and I'm in the pro wrestling business. But back in 1998, he very much wanted to be a pro wrestler, and he wanted to do that after getting out of high school. But then there was a local wrestling company. This is back in 98, so wrestling was hot, and all these schools were popping up. And so in Grand Rapids, there was a company called Pro Wrestling Worldwide. And in May of 98, my brother and I went to the school just to check it out. I was tagging along with him, and he started training there locally, and I just started hanging around. I just became this little 14-year-old mascot there that just did whatever needed to be done, whether it was to set up chairs, set up the ring. I had a video camera, so I would record these shows and I would make copies on the, you know, old VHS copies for the wrestlers. And then I just started doing commentary with the videos that I was recording. And then I started, you know, I had a, man, I haven't thought about this forever. I had a, in my first year and a half or so, 2 years maybe in wrestling, I had a tape company called Jump Jack. Oh, wow. And so I would go and I would record these shows that, you know, my brother would wrestle on, and eventually I would start refereeing and wrestling on. And then I would sell them for $20 on my Hypermart website. And it was just doing anything I could to be around it. And you know, I would play the music a lot. I'd be like a music guy. And even at 14, I had a certain amount of understanding about wrestling where I was capable of, you know, knowing when to hit the music. That's not obvious, right? And then I started the place in Grand Rapids shut down. Another place, you know, about 45 miles away, 30 miles away, opened up called Lakeshore Wrestling Organization. And so that was like the new local place we wrestled, or my brother wrestled. And there was a referee there that was going on vacation one weekend. And they say, hey, we need a referee. And I had been around enough and in the ring enough. So, yeah, I can do that. And once I did that one show, it was on. Like, I made myself this, you know, this Jimmy Jacobs referee website. And I just started like promoting myself and pumping myself out there, just trying to be as much a part of the show as I could at 15 years old.
Cool. What made your brother decide to leave wrestling then? Because it's like, as you just mentioned, he was the one who got into it first, but obviously you're the one who carried on with it. Why did he leave?
He fell in love with Matt. That was it. Fair he was enough. Never the irony in all of this is like he was never good at school. And like, if you would ask parents 30 years ago, which one of your sons is going to grow up to, you know, being a math professor and his PhD in mathematics and travel the world, you know, giving math lectures, and which one of your sons is going to be, you know, successful or moderately successful, at least in the pro wrestling business? My parents definitely, I mean, like, they would have bet the easiest bet ever to take. And somehow we Freaky Friday'd it. My brother was in community college and he started to fall in love with the calculus, and I get it. The calculus is alluring, and that was it. He started doing his math homework in the locker room. He started, you know, he became like the evil Dr. Numbers, and when he wrestled in the last little bit, talking about like probably, you know, probably at his last match, probably in 05, 04, 05 or something. So, yeah, and he's living a very normal life as a math professor.
How proud is he of you, like, succeeding in wrestling and having the career you've had up to now?
I mean, I think there's a certain amount of, you know, of. I think he's proud of me, to an extent, for sure. I remember, like, my first Ring of Honor match back in, like, June of 2003. He called me and he was, like, real choked up. He's like, you did it. You made it. I made was $50, you know, and that was all the time. But yeah.
Cool. And you mentioned Ring of Honor, and I think you debuted about 04, but you quickly jumped in between while you was doing that, you was in CZW, but you also had I don't know if it was a tryout or just a spot match in SmackDown, and you wrestled the legendary Eddie Guerrero. So what was it like wrestling him?
Yeah, so I mean, that was a really great time, a fun time in my career. You know, I started working for Ring of Honor in 2003 and CZW in 2003, along with like IWA in late 2002. So like that was with me and Alex Shelley sort of teaming up, pairing up together and going and starting to traveling on all the independents. That was the time I started to break out. I was like 19 years old and starting to see this company and this company and this company. And then going in 2004 and 05 really started to go from being a lower level guy on the indies, you know, with some buzz to, you know, a more established guy in the indies.
Yeah.
You know, IWA champion, Ring of Honor tag team champion. And then, I went to a SmackDown in Reading, Pennsylvania in May of 2005 just to hang out with my buddy Paul London, and they needed Eddie. And they saw me ringside, and Jimmy Yang was like, "Oh yeah, that kid over there, he can sell." And so they brought me over. They said, "Hey, you're going to work with Eddie tonight." They said, "You know, take off the jewelry. I had piercings on my face at the time. Take off your nail polish, and you know, go find Eddie." And it was great. I saw him, and I said, "Hey, I think we're working together tonight." And he said, "You know, I just want to apologize right now that this match, you know, it needs to be all me. This isn't going to be a competitive match, but I just want to thank you for doing me this favor. Thank you for your professionalism." And he was very generous and very gracious. I mean, he's saying this to me. I'm 21 years old, my first time, you know, working for WWE, first time on television. And he's acting like I'm doing him this great favor. And he was great, man. He showed me that day that, I mean, this guy was certainly a case to me could have been made at that point. He was the best wrestler in the world.
Yeah. You know?
And here I was, 21 years old. I was the difference on the totem pole was as big as he could. And he was treating me like an equal. And that was the lesson Eddie taught me that day, is that it doesn't matter who you are, you treat everybody. And look, I haven't always lived up to that. But it's a lesson that he taught me, that I learned, that I've tried to implement, and it's true. And he took great care of me in the ring. That was the other thing. It's like I had people calling me that day that aired on SmackDown, and you know, I was reading on the message boards, texts, and you know, people saying, "Oh man, it looked like he killed you. It looked like he beat you up." And it's like he took great care of me. He didn't touch me. And that's the art of what we do, is to make it look brutal without it being brutal at all, to leave the match with the same health that you walked into the match. He was great, man.
Cool. And there's one company I want to talk about, which it doesn't get enough love because it only ran for one season, Wrestling Society X. I'll be honest, Jimmy, that was my first exposure to you because I like to find Ring of Honor back in them days, like especially here over the UK, which Mission Impossible pretty much, but Wrestling Society X popped up on MTV and I'm like, "Oh, who's this Jimmy Jacobs? And oh, who's this Tyler Black?" And I loved it. And it's a shame it only went for one season because it was yourselves, Sydal, Teddy Hart. There was so much talent in it and doesn't get enough love. So what was it like WSX wrestling there?
Yeah, you know, you say it doesn't get enough love, but I'll tell you what, man. I've you know, whenever I do a podcast, I get somebody who comes at it with the exact same. Right. It's become this cult favorite for people that were fans of wrestling at that time. It was a great experience for me. You know, the way they treated us was at a higher standard than I was used to, because you're dealing with, you know, a big production company. So like you're getting a per diem and you're in a really nice hotel and, you know, the money they were offering me, which was, you know, huge to me at the time. I mean, it wasn't, you know, $1,000.
Yeah. I know you mean. Yeah.
I mean, 22 was, that's a ton of money. And, it was an interesting experience. It was interesting partly because I'll say I was jaded at 22 because I wasn't, but I was aware enough at 22. I was aware enough at 16. I was aware enough at 15 to know that you can't believe anything nothing happens till it happens, right?
Yeah.
I was used to, you know, when I started at 14 years old and my brother was starting to wrestle and the promoter there and, you know, local crappy Indian in Grand Rapids saying, "Hey, this is going to be like the next ECW and, you know, you're going to be like..." All this sort of stuff. I was used to hearing these big promises like right away in my career. So I never paid them any mind. So some of the allure of this is going, well, you're going to be on MTV and the possibilities, if this is successful, is it's bigger than WWE. This is pop culture. This isn't, you know, at the time was not a particularly popular product. And you go, okay, this is like, this has the potential to, if successful, and they're saying all this stuff to us. This is how they're selling it to us, you know, about you guys, you know, at the MTV Spring Break and presenting awards at the VMAs and, you know, we'll do stuff on Quest Live. And that was, I don't want to say, that was just noise to me. And it was cool that it ended up on MTV. And you got to give, you know, Big Vision Entertainment and Kevin Kleinrock huge props for doing that. But even on being on MTV, it didn't really amount to much of anything after that. It was a fun experience in this bubble, but it was something nice to put on my resume. It was something nice to put on, you know, on the flyers they could put on, you know, MTV wrestler Jimmy J. But it didn't, of course, amount to any material, a success beyond that. Dude, it was a ton of fun, man. It was a ton of fun.
Yeah, it's kind of like how they done Lucha Underground, for example, because loved Lucha Underground, but that only had 3 or 4 seasons and then that died. So it reminds me of kind of like that, really. But yeah, we do miss WSX. Like I said, I loved it, and like the way how it was filmed, like it was such a great show. So I like whenever I pop on YouTube or whatever and I see a clip, I'm like, oh, I'll watch that. So, and like I said, there was so much talent who came through it. So it was great, but eventually you returned to Ring of Honor, and your big noticeable feud at the time was BJ Whitmer. So you had some pretty awesome matches, especially that steel cage match. What was it like feuding with him?
Yeah, you know, BJ was great. You know, he and I were a team. We were tag team champions at Ring of Honor for about 6 months in 2005, and then we started a story with each other. You know, feuding with each other in early 2006, and this is right on the time this event happens where I drunkenly call Gabe Sapolsky, who was the booker, and I was kind of, there was some frustration building because I wasn't on all the shows. I was kind of this like part-time guy, and I wanted to brew, and we just started the storyline with me and Lacey, who was my manager. And the story where I'm like this emo kid who is in love with her, right? We had just started it. And I'm just like, you know, what do I need to do? And Gabe finally laid it out for me. He kind of buried me. He said, look, man, I've given you the opportunities. You and BJ were tag team champions. You guys didn't really get over. We need guys here that, you know, tell stories or have great matches and that sell DVDs. And you don't have those kind of matches. And he just really, he let me know it was up. And which is great, it's such a, you know, we need honesty in this world. It's only through honesty that we can see the game fair, right? If I think this guy likes me and thinks the world of me, but isn't using me all the time, it's like, I don't know what to do. When the guy says, hey, look, we're going to do this one match with you and BJ in Detroit. And if that goes well, maybe we'll do another one. And Gabe's gone on record since saying he was going to finish me up. It was done. It was the end of me. So I went to my buddy's house, who I was in a band with in high school, and we wrote The Ballad of Lacey, and which was this love song to Lacey. And then I went to my other buddy, Mike Z, and we shot this music video, and I sent this thing to Gabe. I was like, I think this is like the thing that's going to get me past the, I was wearing furry boots for a few years doing Huss Huss. And and the music video hit, and Gabe saw it. He's like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. This will be your entrance music. This, you know, all this sort of stuff. And this is right at the advent of YouTube. And so, you know, putting it out on YouTube really, you know, people just, there it is. And they saw this, and it was good enough. So this new character was starting to take form, this emo character who's in love with his manager. And, you know, and with the new music video and the song. Yeah. And then you add BJ Whitmer. And BJ always pushed me to the extra step. You know, there's a certain kind of wrestling I like, and it's not what Ring of Honor does, really. I most enjoy performing at Ring of Honor. I didn't enjoy the in-ring performing. You know, that's not my style. It's not what I like to do. So BJ would always push me that extra step. And so that was really important to have this character that I had, and then BJ Whitmer as well, who always pushed me in the ring to perform a little more than I kind of probably wanted to perform, do more than I wanted to do, and also did me the service of selling for me. You know, if you watch that match, you know, he does me the favor of fucking selling. You tell these, you know, these kids these days, you need to sell. But it's so, as I'm taking heat on him, as he's laying down on the ground, that gives him a chance to get the sympathy that a guy his size is going to get working with me, which might not be much, but it gives me the opportunity to be in the ring and stand there and take that baseball bat wrapped in barbed wire and then hang it from my hair and look the way I look. It gives me that opportunity to be that character while he's doing you the favor of laying on the ground. And DJ was very instrumental in the success of my career.
Yeah, and he's doing pretty well now. He's working as one of the producers over in AEW, so it was nice to see that he's found a new role for himself. So and very underrated talent. Like when I've been back to watch obviously his matches with yourself and other people, such an underrated wrestler and just personality as well. So it's nice to see that he's finding some success for himself as well.
Yeah, well, you start to see that, you know, when you're young, you think success is this very, very elusive thing, a thing that like happens to the lucky ones, the lucky few. And what you start to realize over time is that if you're good, like quality and consistency basically equals success. Is that you're good and you're good constantly, then your career, however small the slope moving up, is going to move up. And that projected over time is going to hit a peak of financial success, of whatever that is. And we're seeing it all throughout the wrestling business. I mean, the business really took a turn back in 2012 when Triple H took over developmental. And he started getting guys who were successful in the independents and bringing them in to WWE. You know, before that, for a lot of time before that, being successful in independents was almost a mark against you. And so now we're seeing that if you're somebody who has this quality, that consistency, that has learned how to get over everywhere you've gone, that you have a certain set of skills, you have a certain set of knowledge, you have a certain set of tools, and a certain, you know, for a lot of these guys, a fan base to walk into WWE and be able to be a player right off the bat. And now with AEW, it's the same thing. You can be a guy who has spent his time on the independents and then just go right here. Because you've accumulated that knowledge, that know-how, the fan base, all those things that have created success for yourself. So it's like, so yeah, Beach of Success, like, of course, anybody that's hearing this right now and struggling with whatever they're in, it's like, you just keep going. And as long as you see that your trajectory is going upwards, you're on the right path. Now, if it's going downwards, you have to reevaluate what you're doing and how you're doing it.
But. Yeah. Cool. And your next big storyline was the Age of the Fall with yourself, Tyler Black, Seth Rollins, and Necro Butcher. So what was it like being pushed and getting this like stable along and being so successful in the stable as well?
Right, yeah, that was my first, you know, main event push in Ring of Honor, and a lot of thought was put into it. The summer of 2007, and we did like, you know, viral marketing campaign.
That's right.
The first one in pro wrestling, and a lot of thought was put into that. Who's going to be in the faction, and how we were going to debut. So it was a very collaborative effort between me and Gabe, and then Tyler Black, you know, Seth Rollins when he came in, and he was young and tapped into certain viewpoints and frames. He came up with the name The Age of the Fall, and it was fantastic. It was a great run, you know, for that year from the time we debuted for a whole year. I mean, I was working on top more than anybody else in the company, and I don't think the experiment with me working on top was considered to be a success, because otherwise I would have stayed there. But you know, so it goes. It was still a it was a great time. Yeah, I mean, it was the most featured I ever was and ever would be in my career. And so from that element of it, it was a great time. But you know, you start to see that, you know, there I was, you know, a year and a half ago or so on the phone with Gabe, you know, in early 2006, and he's telling me, hey, you know, sell the matches on the DVDs, you know, and all I want to do is be on these shows full time. And you fast forward then a year and a half, 2 years later, I'm on all the shows and I'm featured on the top. And it's like, I'm still not, let's say, content, you know, as a human being. I remember in the summer of 2008 feeling just miserable with everything, just miserable. And at that point, you know, Seth and I were your two-time, you know, tag team champions, and we were pushed super heavily. And so my discontentment, it didn't have anything to do really with the spot on the card. Then it started to become about money, and it's like, well, I'm working on top, you know, more than anybody else now, but I'm getting paid a fraction of what some of these other guys are paying, and rightfully so. But yeah, and we're talking small money at the time. It's not like the, you know, Ring of Honor now, all these guys are making, you know, six-figure deals. And at the time, we're talking about a few hundred bucks a show. But no, but it's just it was a great time professionally, in that there probably will never be a bigger stage where on that stage you have no one really to answer to. And we had that at the time. We had a stage that people watched, but we had no masters. It was Gabe and Kerry running the show, and that was it. There's no TV, people, no sponsors, no pay-per-view. There was a pay-per-view thing, and that's when we got our debut got cut off. It's like you basically had nobody to answer. So you had so much creative freedom with none of the restrictions. So it was a great time in my career to be able to create completely freely.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know if it was just after that time or a little bit later, Jim Cornette came into the mix, and he's kind of what we call him over here. He's like, man, Mike, you rather love him or you hate him. But was you there when Cornette was there? I think he was, wasn't you?
I mean, at what point? Jim was there a few times.
About 07, 08, was he there, I think? It's kind of sketchy because he always seems to be in and out.
Look, he was there. I worked with him in 04 when we did stuff with him and Bobby Heenan together. He was in 06
doing 06 must have been,
angle with Homicide in 06. And then of course in 2011 he helped, you know, 10-11 to sell Ring of Honor to Sinclair Broadcasting Group. And
I think it was 11,
there for all of us.
Yeah. What was your personal experience with him like?
I always liked Jim, you know. First of all, I think Jim as a performer, as a promo, is one of the best of all time. For what he does is, you know, just an amazing talker for sure. I mean, there's different kinds of talkers, you know. What he does isn't exactly, you know, what Mick Foley does, which isn't exactly what John Cena does, but for what Jim does, you know, one of the best. And he certainly had a vision for Ring of Honor. I don't think, you know, Jim was never a particularly big fan of mine. I didn't fit in the in kind of what the product was offering when him and Hunter Johnson were running the show in 2011 when I came back. I took a couple years off, came back the day they announced Claire purchase. And so I wasn't a Jim Cornette guy. You know, I wasn't, you know, Davey Richards was the Jim Cornette guy. Like that, that was the guy you're going to build around because you're offering this sort of like sports alternative of professional wrestling as opposed to sports entertainment. It's a sport. And so you want guys like Davey Richards who look like athletes and move like athletes and they're performing almost like MMA, you know, and I wasn't that thing. And, but I was still featured enough. You know, there's guys that Jim didn't see in that box of what Ring of Honor should be. And it's like, fair enough. You're trying to get this product, giving it to a new audience. And so you have a certain brand you're trying to put on it, of this athleticism. Yes, I'm not in that thing. But he's always been nice to me. He's always been cordial to me. I think he's a very smart guy. I don't agree with everything that he says. I see something a bit different than he does, and he's got his experience to give him his insight. I have whatever experience I have to give me mine.
Cool. And one of the things I did want to mention about Ring of Honor, the one thing I did enjoy was the storylines he was put on, because it's the one thing I always find, like, besides Impact, because I'm actually loving Impact, but I don't know, a lot of, there doesn't seem to be great storylines happening. Like, a lot of it seems to be tame, where Ring of Honor would, like, think outside the box sort of thing. And I always loved those storylines. One of the ones I did love, you mentioned earlier, Lacey, and there was, like, the storyline between your two. Austin Aries came into it, and he basically stole her away. You're crying in the ring. The fans are chanting, cry, Jimmy, cry. So I just wanted to say I loved all that. But what was it like working that angle, especially with Lacey and Austin Aries at the time?
Yeah, that was great. I remember that night in Chicago. I was out from there in like four or five segments. And that promo me and Aries did in the ring, I remember thinking, like, that was gangbusters. When he, I was trying to recruit him for Age of the Fall, and he finally turns me down. And we have this moment, and he snatches the mic from me, and then later on he gets Lacey. And yeah, it was great creating like that. You know, Gabe and I got along really well as far as, you know, making these storylines. And one thing, you know, I learned a lot from Gabe, and one of the things is it takes balls to be a good booker. It's like you have to go for it. And that's scary sometimes, especially when you have, you know, people to answer to, and you got, well, this, you, and, you know, in WWE, what ends up happening is people talk themselves into mediocrity. You go, well, I don't want to do this. Well, we don't want to damage this guy. We don't want to damage this guy. We don't want to. And so you end up taking the path that is the least offensive. And I don't mean that as far as like, oh, you're going to offend people. I mean, just like that does the least amount of damage, that just like,
I know,
just like you're just going to get through today. I hope everything's fine. And that's it. Instead of going, you know what? You know, fuck it. We're going to hang a guy. I'm going to shower in his blood. And if it's good, it's good. If it's not, it's not. And for that year that I was on top, it's like, we're going to try for Jimmy Jacobs, and it's going to work or it's not. And you look, sometimes things work and sometimes things don't. When, Morishima was world champion in 2007, it was like, we're going to go for it. And it took a little bit to get going. Morishima was not hitting on all cylinders when he was first champion. It started to come into its own. But I really started to learn that working with Gabe, and it was a pleasure to create with him.
Cool. And one thing I noticed as well, like, as you watch Ring of Honor over the years, like, so much of the talent found their way towards WWE, in particular, like, Kevin Steen, obviously Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, there's loads. Them two is the main two that pops off the top of my head. The one, the two guys what never seemed to jump ship, though, was the Briscoes. Why do you think they never left and they always stayed loyal to Ring of Honor?
Well, I mean, certainly at one point, at least, it was a tweet that Jay sent out that I think that, this is probably about 10 years ago or so, that WWE they wanted the Briscoes at a certain point.
Yeah.
And that sort of blocked them. And then priorities start to change. I don't know if they've officially gotten offers from WWE in the last, years. And I believe that they did. I don't want to speak exactly their business. I don't exactly know.
Yeah.
But I'm impression that they have been offered deals, but your priorities change. And as Ring of Honor's company's grown, so has these people's money. And all of a sudden, all these guys there are making good money. Like Ring of Honor can make good money, especially if you're a top guy like the Briscoes are, who are just brilliant performers. They're absolutely phenomenal. They did so much for me in my career, and they just got better over time. And so it's like, all right, do you want to go to WWE and, you know, have to move to Florida? And okay, then maybe you can work out where they don't move to Florida, but do you want to go there and, you know, put your career in the hands of Triple H or Vince McMahon and tag team? It's like, oh, well, they've never really, you know, what tag teams have gone there and been, you know, successful.
Yeah.
And so you go, yeah, man, I like it in this world that I've helped create. And I can't speak for them, but I would guess it's probably something like that. It's like there was probably a time where the Briscoes would have gone to WWE, but as you get older and have families and your priorities change, and you see that you don't need WWE to be successful, and you know, when I worked at WWE, I realized very early on, it's a very specific thing. WWE is a very specific thing. And unless you like that specific thing, or you're just okay with whatever, you know, you go, whatever, it's fine. And I don't know if that's a great way to live. For people that are creatively motivated, which so many pro wrestlers tend to be, WWE does not seem to be an environment that fosters a lot of fulfillment. So why go to WWE and be in a place you're probably going to be miserable, probably. You are, you might not even be successful. And you go, yeah, man, who needs it? And that's probably something like what happened with them. But that's their business, I guess.
But it's true about the tag teams. I recently spoke to Orlando Colon, Epico, and a great guy. Loved chatting to him. He was a great guy. And he was the same sort of thing. He spoke of his frustrations with, like, Triple H said to him, he said, I'll be honest with you, Vince does not like tag teams. And he spoke to me about, like, just being frustrated. He said, not being able to express the characters or anything like that. So you're right on the money when you said all that, because, you know, that's what he said as well.
I think it's a very common thing there. See, to be successful in professional wrestling, generally speaking, there's a certain spark inside of you, and they call that spark passion. And, you know, and a bit oddness, you know, it takes a certain kind of person to want to be a pro wrestler. It takes another kind of person to go and actually do it. It takes another kind of person to then keep doing it. It takes another kind of person to then be successful at it to the point that WWE wants to hire them. So you have this very unique kind of person that's very passionate, and their passion is the thing that's carried them to WWE. But then once you're there, that passion ends up being the thing used against you because you care so much. And now your career is in the hands of this madman, so to speak. When it's his show, he can run it however he wants. But for performers that want to express themselves and care about the storylines and care about, you know, this and that, and want to craft something out of their careers, it has a tendency to be very, very frustrating for, I would say, a lot of individuals. I don't want to say in totality, because certainly there are guys that have had great careers there and are probably happy there, and I can't speak for them.
Yeah.
But that seemed to be a pattern that was prevalent there, and it bred a lot of discontentment.
And still does. And while we're on the subject, I suppose, eventually you left Ring of Honor. You had that great angle at the end where you mentioned the music video, the lazy they played that and stuff. But you eventually got your way into WWE. What was the first thing you noticed, like, actually arriving into the company? Like, was anything what was like, wow, was this how they do things sort of thing?
I mean, there was a lot of things I didn't expect. One was, I was in the writer's room probably about an hour before I realized that all the writers are smart people that know what they're talking about. And they have this reputation. There's the guys from Hollywood that don't know anything about wrestling. It's like, no, that's not true at all. And all the guys, I mean, the smartest guys I've met in wrestling are likely guys that are writers at WWE, and probably there right now. Like, if I was booking a dream team or even just one guy to go, okay, who's gonna be my booker? Who are gonna be my guys that run my shows? It would be people from the WWE creative team.
Yeah.
And that's a surprise. I came there thinking like I was going to know things and these people weren't learning, and all very talented, very smart, all in different ways, very creative. Everybody was creative in different ways. It was so cool to be a part of this team that had so many talented people from, you know, the guys that were great, you know, writers, like pen to paper writers, and guys that were great storytellers, and guys that were good crafters, and guys that were good at doing the stuff with levity or comedy, or guys that were good at doing the serious stuff. And you know, all sorts of very talented people. And so that was a surprise. Seeing the operation from the inside, I mean, really from the inside too, as far as producing live TV every Monday, it took me a while to go, whoa, man, this is a huge operation and I can't believe it runs. It's like you see how live TV works and how you know, Vince works with these changes in the scripts and all sorts of stuff. And at the end of it, you go, how did we do that today? How did something not fall completely off the rails? I mean, that was something, and you have to give so much credit to the operation and the people behind it. And Vince has a lot of very good people. And, you know, to Kevin Dunn, who I know a lot of people don't have good things to say about him. And Kevin could be a certain way.
Yeah.
No doubt. But he was very good at his job.
Yeah.
Kevin, you know, he was sharp. I mean, you have to be, you're doing a 10 things at once when you're the producer of that show. And, you know, that was another thing that really stuck with me when I first got there.
And I was working out the dates because you started officially in April, I think, and it must have been within days or at least a week or so when Seth Rollins cashed in WrestleMania. So was you in attendance, or if not, how did you feel?
Yeah, so I had my final match that weekend at Ring of Honor.
That's right.
San Francisco area, in the Bay Area. And then I flew home. I was living in Detroit at the time. And I watched WrestleMania like the following, I forget if our show was on Friday or Saturday, but then I flew home. And then on Sunday, you know, that weekend, I packed all my stuff. Sunday night, I watched WrestleMania. I watched my friend, you know, win the world title in the main event. And I said, all right, man, here we go. And, you know, right after that, I hopped in my car. I mean, right after the show was over, I hopped in my car and drove to Stamford, Connecticut. And I got there on Monday and I started on Wednesday.
Cool. I can imagine then, because I think I might have this wrong, but I think Seth recommended you to WWE. And I would imagine you had some sort of an input creative for his, you know, his original title run, which was a great title run. We absolutely loved it. So did you have much input in his first title run?
So Seth, you know, he probably had a small hand. I mean, he was probably a voice of, I mean, he certainly was a voice of support for me. The two guys that really recommended me to WWE to come on the creative team were Joey Mercury and Daniel Bryan. They brought me to the manager of the creative team, David Kapoor, and said, hey, this is Jimmy Jacobs. He's a genius. He belongs in the team. And I got to give those guys credit. You know, I didn't have a, you know, a, look, the writing team is it's a big team. It's probably about 25 people. And I didn't have a huge hand in the creative when it came to Seth's first title run. I was a low man on the totem pole, and Seth was the world champion.
Yeah.
And, you know, not to say I couldn't give ideas for stories for him, but the things I was doing pen to paper, I had my hands on were like, you know, when you start there, you're filling in for the lowest card stuff. You know, I'm, you know, Bo Dallas promos or this offhanded, you know, Ron Killings promo or something like that. And that's the sort of the things you're assigned to do early on are these.
Yeah.
You're a utility player for the talent that isn't top talent, that doesn't have, you know, when you start getting towards the upper echelon, those guys have writers that, you know, that basically work with them on every story they do, you know, that, and that's how it became with, you know, me and Chris Jericho and Kevin Owens. Like I was always on their stuff. And then I became always on AJ Styles stuff. And I was always, last year I was there, I was always on John Cena's stuff. I mean, that was,
cool. And the other guy who came up with the list of Jericho, which we all loved.
Yeah, very fun. Very, very fun stuff. It was incredible working with Chris. You know, it's his 30th anniversary of, you know, his time in professional wrestling, and he's making a case right now. Yeah, certainly one of the greatest of all time. I mean, compared to, you know, if you look at what we did 4 years ago, which was fun, which was great. I mean, the list at one point was, you know, probably got the loudest reactions.
It did.
The show, you know, the guy pulls out a pen and goes, you know what happens? The place explodes. And, you know, it was a fun thing. And then to see him go from that to then what he then went to New Japan, to go outside of the WWE world, you know, for the first time in years, really, and be this other character in New Japan, and then go to AEW and be the guy that AEW needed, you know, as much as, you know, they wanted to build around, you know, whatever, the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega and then Cody.
Yeah.
They, you know, AEW needed that guy that people knew in order for TNT to want to put something on. It's like, you know, for you and me, the Young Bucks might be great, but for Martha and Joe at home in Tennessee, they don't know anything about them, but they know Chris Jericho. And so now Chris Jericho has been a driving force in a new resurgence, you know, in the wrestling business. And at the time, you know, when we started working together, I didn't know him at all, but he got on with Kevin really well. They had great chemistry on screen. And we did like one pre-tape. Fuck, where were we? Yeah, we did one pre-tape with them together, and they were just like gold together. And then Chris worked with Kevin. I was always doing Kevin's stuff, and I was doing a lot of Chris's stuff early on too. But he just didn't know me. And there was a little bit of growing pains at first. There was a few times he was hostile to me, and you know, suffer people lightly. And rightfully so. He's a legend. He's a legend. And he was doing a thing with John Moxley, with Dean Ambrose that we did. I think I was doing that stuff. And where Chris had Dean cut up his light up jacket, right? And that was Chris's thing. And for Chris to go, okay, the thing that everybody knows me for right now, getting rid of it, throwing it out. It's really like jumping out of the airplane with no parachute and going, yeah, it's all right. I'll figure out how to land. You know, I'm Chris Jericho. I don't know how I'm going to land, but I know I will. And so I think and this is just me from my perspective. We've never talked about this, but I think he was, say, on edge about it. But there's probably, you know, there's some concern. It's like, you don't know exactly what your thing's going to be. And so there was a little, you know, there is that growing of trying to figure out what new thing he's going to fit into. But once we started getting on that, the gift to Jericho, drink it in, man, once and stupid idiot. And then the list of Jericho was the thing that put it over the edge. And then it just became a blast. Once we got it, once it was like, this is the new Chris Jericho. I mean, he was a absolute pleasure to work with, and it was so much fun to just get whatever stupid thing. Everything became the something of Jericho, you know, the door of Jericho, shut it closed, man. Like, just all and he was talking silly catchphrases. You're gonna get it, and it was a blast.
Cool. And you mentioned earlier, I truly believe myself, like you said, some of the writers WWE have got know what they're doing, and they come up with these great ideas. Like, while you was in the creative meetings, like, obviously it's well known that Vince can change the show within 10 minutes of it starting. What were some of the best creative pitches you heard, what for one reason or another got turned down flat? Is there any, well, off the top of your head you can remember, like, good ideas?
I've been asked that question a lot, and it's a hard one for me to answer because there are just so many ideas. That part of the job is just to be a prolific idea guy, and you're just putting all the stuff out, and so much of it gets changed. And, you know, it's like most of the ideas don't make it. Some ideas start to and then get changed, and then at the 11th hour, It's hard for me to say, oh yeah, what? There's one I'm really liking. Jeez, I can't even remember it now. Yeah, but I mean, there's just so many. It's a part of the job to come up with ideas that don't get used.
Yeah. And
it's not obvious that these things would have been better. I think there are some things that would have been good. I mean, really good that came out of the creative, you know, I mean, there's so many creative people there, but it's Vince's show, so Vince has to be the final call, or Vince chooses to be the final call, and somebody has to be the final call, and it's Vince's show, so Vince gets to do that.
Yeah, because I think like a lot of speculation, the reason he has so many writers, even though he probably, you know, at the end of the day, you probably think, oh, I'll just do it my way. A lot of the reasons why people think yes, a team of so many, so just like one or two people, is because when Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara writ for him, obviously they, you know, jumped ship to WCW, and a lot of people theorize that he got betrayed. He felt betrayed over that, and because he put so much of his trust in just like two writers, I think he's actually scared that it happened again if he just relies on one or two people. So that's why he has a whole team now, and instead of just having one or two people. But that's Vince. He's very eccentric, and one of the things I'm gonna have to mention. Have you got a story for that?
I wouldn't give any credence to that theory at all. Look, with the things that the writers became tasked to do increased. Yeah. It wasn't just about, I mean, if you look at the scripts from 20 years ago to compared to now, it's like these were, it's like you're dealing with a different level of performer, not to disparage anybody. How about this? Or performers that Vince doesn't trust as much.
Yeah.
Don't quite have the chops that some of these old performers did. And Vince has become more meticulous. And, you know, and you have sponsors to worry about. So the tasks have become greater. So now these scripts are written, they're written word for word. And it's a lot of work. It's not a small amount of work. First, because it's like you have to, Raw's 3 hours. So you have to come up with 16 segments. There's 15 commercial breaks, you have to come up with 16 segments. And so you're writing all these promos, you know, word for word, and all the backstages. And so it's like, there's the ideas that you have to come up with, you know, that, and then there's those pieces. Then there's, you got to put the pieces in there. That's a whole job right there, is putting the ideas and going, okay, now it's going to be this, and this is how the show is going to look. And then you go, look, I'm going to write this. And then come day of the TV, because it's 3 hours, because, you know, you have whatever, you know, 16 segments, but also backstages and stuff. So now the writers are tasked with producing these things, which means that I have to go and I've got to, you know, give this to the talent, and we've got to talk it over. I've got to make sure they've got it down. I mean, it's, and then you have SmackDown, and then you have 205, you have NXT, and you have NXT UK. And so, I mean, and then the pay-per-views, and then whatever things also just happened to come up, and whatever other side things. I was never there going, oh man, there's way too many people here. If there's 25 people in the room and they're all trying to give ideas, it's too many people. But when all these different pieces of everything, of, you know, 11 hours of TV programming a week on average, right? It's like 3 hours of Raw, 2 hours of SmackDown, an hour of 205 Live, an hour of NXT, an hour of the UK show, and then plus a pay-per-view, you know, once a month. So let's say 9 hours, something like that.
Yeah.
9 hours of programming. Plus then at some point you had, like, you know, talking smack and things like that. So, I mean, it's, you know, and then whatever else on the network too, sometimes we were tasked to do. So it's the job has just increased exponentially, and the tasks that the writers needed to do just increased so much because Vince is so meticulous and doesn't trust the talent to come up with their own promos. And a lot of times, rightfully so.
Yeah.
For all of Vince's things, I don't disagree with. Look, I think they're micromanaged too much. I think they're overly scripted. But here's my experience. My experience is this. If you say to wrestler A, hey, what do you want to say? Here's what they're going to say. They're going to say, hey, you know, James, come this Saturday, I'm going to kick your ass. And you're going to say, yeah, you know what? Well, I'm going to kick your ass. You know, you're going down. And it's just like going to be this trite variation of I'm going to kick your ass. And look, that's fine for one story. But when you have 3 hours of Raw and 2 hours of SmackDown, hour 205 Live, and hour NXT, when you have all this programming, every story can't have guys going, yeah, you know what? Well, I'm going to kick your ass. You know, I've been doing this for 21 years, and you're not going to be the guy to take it from me. You're like, all right, yeah, okay, fine. The idea of, hey, go out there and cut a promo about this, the amount of guys that can do that well, it's a small group. And I think that you gotta start to get these guys off their training wheels a little bit. I believe that, but it's not my show, it's Vince's show. So it could be, I feel like it should be less scripted exactly. But Vince has his concerns, and some of his concerns are valid. It's that wrestlers will always want to say the same things. It's that, you know, Vince wants to make sure that the stories are told properly. It's he doesn't want anybody saying anything that he doesn't know because of sponsors, because, you know, you're going to get Ric Flair out there saying, like, I'm going to make you bleed like a virgin. I think it's Chrysler there, you know, that day. And that happened. And so Vince is like, yeah. I need to make sure every word that they're going to say, I'm going to know. Yeah, it's okay. It's all fair. So that's the show.
Yeah. It's a good explanation, really. Before we leave WWE topic, you mentioned the Bayley and John Cena. What was he like to work with? I can imagine he's just the ultimate professional.
Love John Cena, man. John Cena is one of my, you know, I don't know if the word hero is right, but he's definitely somebody I admire. He is the, you know, hardest working guy there, I would say, you know, from my perspective. He, the top guy there, and also just the most, the nicest, not the nicest, like, he's the one guy there that could be an asshole to everybody, but is exceptionally nice to everybody. And that's true kindness, right? You know, it's one thing for me to go there and be nice to people because I got no pole and I'm just the low guy in the totem pole. So I, you know, I'm just going, yes, sir, yes, sir. You know, oh, let me get this for you. That's one thing. It's a whole other thing to be the guy that has the power to bear you, that has the power to be, you know, be an asshole to you with no repercussions, who then chooses not to wield his sword and you know, instead chooses to keep it sheathed. And he was always very kind. He's very charismatic, and he is open to ideas from everybody. At the end of the day, he can make his decision, but he wants to hear it from everybody. And that's something I look at as somebody who, to me, that's a quality of somebody who's successful, is being open to everything and not just, look, there's balance. You know, people who have so much tunnel vision without anything from the outside can you know, run right into a wall because they don't see everything. People that are too easily swayed by everything else going there, they're not going to hit their goal. But a good professional, somebody who's successful, you know, has their focus, but listens to the voices out here, listens to the people out here. And John is, you know, I wish him all the success with everything he does. And I know he'll have it because that's what he works towards. I remember one time I was on a call or something with Kevin Owens, and they're in the UK or on some Europe tour, and he was hanging out with John, and John had just come back from injury, and they were at like a bar, and John was like playing the piano because John had learned how to play the piano while he was off injured. You know, that's just something, you know, in addition to doing, you know, learning his Mandarin every single day, it's like, oh yeah, let me learn how to play the piano. Let me do this. And so I look at John and go, there's a guy that's living. There's a guy that's doing it right. There's a guy that is, you know, putting one foot in front of the other, you know, going after what he wants, putting in, having the discipline and willpower to do it, but also being kind to the people he's around as he's doing it, to foster those relationships and leave the world better than he left it. And I have so much admiration for John Cena.
Cool. He always comes across as such a great guy, so it's just nice to hear like some nice stories about him. And another guy.
I used to say, and sometimes still do, man. Sometimes I still do. It's like, what would John Cena do? I mean, for real. Sometimes if you're in a situation, you go, what would John Cena do? You know, if somebody's acting a certain way and you want to be mad about it, it's like what would John Cena do? He would be cool. He would be cool as hell about it and just probably make a dick joke and that's lets that stuff just brush off him, man. Lets that stuff, you know, brush off him. And he's definitely somebody I admire. Yeah,
cool. And another guy who I find similar, Roman Reigns. I've always supported him. I've always thought like there's a super, like he's always been a big star, but I've always thought there's a superstar waiting, but it's just the right booking. And fans have been crying out for him to turn heel for such a while, but now that he has, and these games just went another level. But I don't know if you watch much WWE, but if you have, what do you think of his current run he's doing now? And also, what was he like acting with, like being in person?
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the new stuff. I know that he's there. I believe Paul Heyman is with him. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, he's doing a family storyline now with his cousin Jay.
Right.
And it's like it's kind of like the having him like the tribal chief of his family. He's like the breadwinner. It could be leading to him and The Rock, so we don't know. But I'll be honest, Jimmy. I've always supported Roman, but I would say what he's doing now is probably the best work of his career, I would say. So
yeah, Roman is super talented, and there was so much there, like you said, there's a superstar in there, and the booking of him was poor. It was very poor. I think it was the year before I got there, right? 2014. Right. So there was two courses, right? On one hand, you had the heel that they were building, which was Brock Lesnar, and they did the best job ever of making a monster. He ended the squash John Cena at Survivor Series, and so you got this. And then at the same time, you're trying to make your new star because you know John Cena isn't going to be there forever, and you're going to do that with Roman Reigns. And the handling of Roman Reigns was so just in everybody's face that they were, and look, you can't overcomplicate things sometimes, but it was so obvious where they were going. And once you say, hey, this is your guy, you're supposed to like this guy, people go, don't tell me who my guy is, you know. And that really culminated at Royal Rumble of 2015 when and in that one match, you saw a microcosm of what they had done with Roman the whole last year, which is to say, this is your guy, whether you like it or not. Let's get rid of all the guys that you might want to win the Royal Rumble, you know, towards the end. Just get rid of all of them. So you have no choice but to, but to like Roman Reigns. And if that doesn't help, here's The Rock. And now you'll like
it.
And so he was thrust into this very unenviable spot. And when Vince gets his hands on something too deeply, Vince can be very out of touch, and you can end up with promos where with the suffering succotash and, you know, telling stories about Jack and the Beanstalk and things like that. And so Roman had it a bit rough in the way he was handled. And you had everybody in his ear saying, no, you need to do this. No, you need to do this. You know, you got Steve Austin saying you need to put on more holds. You got whatever Michael Hayes is telling him here, and all the other agents and everybody. And so he was in a hard position, no doubt. But he was a superstar. And when he came out, there was more electricity in the air for his entrance than anybody else when I was there. There was electricity in the air. And a lot of those were boos. Some of those were cheers, but a ton of electricity. And I'm happy. I always liked Roman. I thought he was very talented. He had some amazing matches. I mean, I remember him and AJ Styles. It was in Chicago.
That's right,
had a really great match. Yeah, Roman was as good as anybody there. There was just a lot of stink of being the company guy on him. And people know it's the angle they ran 20 years ago with The Rock being the corporate champion. It's like when people, hey, this is your guy, we want you to be the champion. People go, no, that's not our guy. We want Dean Ambrose to be the champion because you haven't telegraphed it. You haven't forced us to like him. You forced us to like this guy. You haven't forced us to like him. So I always got along with Roman. I loved him. We did the stuff with him and Cena together, and really, really enjoy that guy.
Cool. And eventually you departed, obviously, about that picture, which you've probably said the same. You've told every podcast about the same story about the picture. But you, obviously, they invaded and, you know, you took your picture with your friends, which was nothing wrong, but WWE wasn't happy. But you've said, like, in many interviews, you actually count it as a blessing, in fact, you could finally leave because you... Not exactly, you wasn't angry or, you know, depressed about being there, but you wasn't as happy as what you could be. And you said things like, you know, I hated wearing suits. I like dressing the way you dress. So like, I would imagine having that picture and them not being happy, it was like a blessing in disguise. It was like, yeah, I'm actually ready to go.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it was a blessing. Even the day it happened, and I had, you know, was sort of reprimanded for it, and I a journal. I remember writing on the bus that night, going, they might fire me for this. And there was this exhilaration of going, oh, I could do whatever I wanted then. And because, look, as humans, we feel trapped a lot, right? And we're trapped really by fear. We're trapped by fear of the unknown. And you go, oh, geez, what if, you know, man, if I lost my job, what would I do? And I need money. And you have all these limiting beliefs that keep you in this box, keep you scared from making the next move in your life. And so this picture was, it was such a blessing. And it was a lesson. It was a lesson to go from the universe to go, hey, there's nothing to fear. You know, you can make these decisions. You know, you could have quit, and there's something on the other side, and it's fine. And you can, you know, you'll work through that. You'll get to where you need to go. There's always something else. The way you're living now is not the way you have to live. And this is true for everybody. Your perspective is not reality. It's just a point of view. And you're not trapped by the things you think you're trapped by. You're trapped by the things in your mind.
Yeah.
It was amazing. I mean, you know, the day it happened, there was excitement when I thought, oh, maybe they'll fire me. I didn't think they were going to fire me. But then the day I got fired, it was relief. It was it's over. Great. It's over. And then it was exhilarating going, I don't know what I'm going to do next. Awesome. Yeah. And then, you know, as, you know, for the, you know, a month or two, 3 months after that, I had this short 15 minutes where I was hot again. And it was so much fun. It was the most fun time of my career. And just playing again and just performing again and being in demand. It was just, it was like, oh man. I remember thinking, how long would I have stayed there? I was like, I'd have stayed there another 2 years and just been miserable like everybody else there. And yeah, It was an amazing. I'm grateful for my time in WWE. But I wake up on Mondays and just think, oh man, I'm so glad I'm not at Monday Night.
Cool. And you eventually found your way to Impact Wrestling. So how did that come about? Because obviously AEW started, you know, a couple of years afterwards, which I think a lot of people thought you'd be jumping over there as well, because that's where your friends are. But you stayed with Impact. But how do you find yourself at Impact Wrestling and debuting at Bound for Glory?
Yeah, you know, I've known Scott D'Amore, who took over Impact Wrestling shortly before I got fired.
Yeah.
And I've known Scott since I was like 16, maybe. Oh, wow. And so Scott called me, said, hey, we should have a conversation and we should see if, you know, we should date, see if you like us and we like you. And so... they brought me into Bound for Glory just to sort of check me out and so I could check them out. And I was exactly the kind of guy they needed. You know, they were at a time at that point where they were really starting to trim a lot of fat. It was out of hand, you know, when Jeff Jarrett was running. They were no longer on Spike TV. So that money wasn't coming in, but they were still running budgets like as if the Spike TV money was coming in. And so they needed somebody there who could wear a lot of hats. And I go, great. I'm that guy. And the first day they're like, yeah, just do as much as you want to do or are comfortable doing. And I jumped right in it. I'm like, yeah, like this is, you know, the things you need are the things that I've, you know, done as a performer for years, done just as a creative mind for years, and then did in WWE for the 2.5 years before that. And like, I'm right here. I can sit here and call a promo, call a match. I can produce this thing here. I can do all that like now. And so I walked right in and I started, you know, helping them out with the scripts that, you know, the night of Bound for Glory, you know, after the show was over, we go back to the hotel. We look over the next day's scripts, which is something I'm used to doing and, you know, changing things around and making alterations. And I'm on the computer changing stuff. And it's like, yeah, we're here. And it was just a really good, it's been a really good fit for the last 3 years.
Yeah. I spoke to Scott last night. I was on the press call for Bound for Glory. Great guy, really is. And the main thing him and Don Callis done, like I said, when they took over TNA or Impact Wrestling, it was in such a mess. And It's been a steady ride, but the rebuilding job they've done and like the success they've had up to now this year, it's been amazing. So I'm so thankful for them. But one of the things I did want to mention about the following year, the 2018 Bound for Glory, I think that's right. You mentioned about the Austin Aries and the match he had with John Morrison, like when he took the finish and he just walked out. What was the deal with that? Because some people said it was planned, it was scripted, like why he walked out after the match finished, but other people said it was like a shoot. So I don't know if you've been asked this, but if you haven't, can you clarify why that happened?
You know, the truth is I wasn't a part of the planning of how the end of that pay-per-view. Right. And so I was not in the conversation. So it's like, you know, Austin Aries is going to have his point of view of what he did. And, you know, I don't know what Scott and Don's perspective of it is exactly. But it, look, there was a lot there. Aries can be he's an extremely talented performer, you know, like all of them, can be his own worst enemy. And he did a lot of great work for us. And going into that pay-per-view, he created a lot of buzz for us online. He created more buzz for us in like a tweet than we had done the whole 4 or 6 week build to him and John. So look, Aries is a very smart guy. And he had people, you know, you're talking to me about that finish 2 years later. So he's a very smart guy. So it's, it was chaotic that day.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was changes of plans through it all. You know, Aries, you know, going into Bound for Glory, we had planned on Aries being there after that. And then, you know, they had sort of made the decision for him to lose and then at least go away for a little bit. And it was I remember being a stressful day and a stressful night rewriting the 4 weeks of TV without him on it. We had planned, we had written TV with him to be on it. And I think it was personally, I think it was a little bit of miscommunication just in that. I think Aries wanted to do this thing after the match to get some buzz. And I think he went a little further than, I don't know if it was talked about or what they thought he was going to do. But it was what exactly happened. I don't think is exactly what they talked about, but again, I wasn't in the room.
All right, that's fair. And the other thing as well, you kind of made history this year as well, putting the championship on Tessa Blanchard, which she became like the first female wrestler to be the world champion of a major wrestling company. So how did that come about? Like, was there a lot of brainstorming thinking, should we try it? Or what led to that decision of making her the champ?
Yeah, I mean, look, she was the most over talent on our show, you know? Yeah. You know, on our live shows, she got the biggest reactions, and she's really a once in a generation performer. I think I don't think you could have done this with a whole lot of other talents, but she performs at a level where you're like, I think we can do it. I think we can pull it off. And the timing seemed right. You know, there's a lot of intergender wrestling that goes on, and it just. She seemed like the talent to do it with. It seemed like the time to do that as well. And to tell her story and to tell that story of, I mean, that we did for, you know, first when she, you know, when she beat Gail Kim in April of whatever it was, April of 19. And then
the
whole story and the story with Sammy and then her winning title in January of this year. It seemed like the story to tell. The fans seemed like, This is their guy, and I was in full support of it, man. I really think the world of Tessa certainly, and I think she really performs up to an elite caliber level. I hope we're she's so talented that I just hope wherever she go, she's going to do well. You know,
yeah.
I hope at the end of it, she gets the success that she really deserves. Because, you know, as far as the United States goes, and I guess I don't watch a whole bunch, you know, of anything anymore, but over the last few years, I would put her work up against anybody, against, you know, Charlotte, and, you know, Tessa Blanchard, Charlotte Flair, main eventing WrestleMania sounds good to me, so.
Oh, yeah, two daughters of the legendary Horsemen. Story writes itself. one of the things I did want to mention as well, like, so the creative, and we mentioned earlier with Ring of Honor and the storylines they had. To me, these days, Impact Wrestling seems to carry a lot of the old school Ring of Honor and ECW kind of feel. That's how I look at Impact now. I kind of look at it as like an old school Ring of Honor and also ECW. And the storylines you do, and like, say, Wrestle House and all that good stuff, you're not scared to do these things. And like the Dark Dimension, Rosemary, who I absolutely love, I would love to interview her one day. She's been a fan of her for years. But all these out-of-the-box ideas, like Dark Dimension, like, how does it feel having such a free reign of having these ideas and creative?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the great things about Impact Wrestling, is that we can do these things and we can take chances. And it's great to be at a place where you can take chances and try things. I mean, just like we did with, you know, with Tessa Blanchard, you know, like I was talking about, yeah. Gabe, good booking takes balls. And it's like, you know, unfortunately with the Tessa Blanchard reign, it's, you know, then this COVID stuff happened and we just never had her back. And so we didn't get to telling that story and say, oh, was it a success or not? It's like, oh, I don't know. And we got some criticism for it, but I wouldn't take that back at all.
No.
It's like, you gotta go for it. You have to go for it. If you don't go for it, nothing's gonna happen. And so it's like, well, what are you gonna do when now we can't have an audience in our crowd anymore? Like, what are you gonna do? You just keep putting on matches in front of nobody? It's like, I mean, yes, but you know, what else? It's like, oh, let's bring a bunch of people to a house and have them live together. Tell stories that way and do something. And, you know, and people enjoyed that a lot. And I enjoyed doing it a lot. And you know, you got to give credit to Don and Scott for being here for those things, for taking a company that was in shambles, that had, you know, financially in shambles, the reputation, the name of TNA was tarnished, of, you know, of Impact Wrestling. It was embarrassing to be a fan of the product. And taking that to going to a product that's like, hey, man, I enjoy watching this. Hey, this is good stuff. Hey, did you see this thing they did? Hey, they went to, you know, fucking, you know, doing stuff on Realm where, you know, Sue Young takes Chair in a coffin and then Allie's got to go to hell to go and fucking, you know, and get her back. It's like, let's do it. And maybe it sucks. I don't know. It's like, I don't know if it's going to suck or not. I just know that we can either do that or two people can have a match in the ring together. And that's fine. We have a lot of, but let's play a little bit. Let's have a, you know, a parking lot gang fight between LAX and the OG, you know, let's do it. Let's go for it. And that's the fun part about doing it. And some of it's, you know, some of it works and some of it, you know, probably doesn't work as much as we would hoped it would work, but like,
yeah,
this is what you do. This is what you do when you try to create something as opposed to just be there and just, all right, let's get to the next week and let's get to the next week and let's just get to the next week and let's just hope people watch. It's like, all right, fine. You know, WWE can do that. That's
It's
every once in a while Vince will want to do something that's, you know, that's out of the box and try to, you know, it's not to say he never does, but and it's hard when you're doing so much content, you can't do crazy new things all the time, but it's good to be in an environment where you can suggest and then attempt things that are out of the box. You know, Vince says he likes new ideas, but you know, only sometimes, a little bit, every once in a while, maybe really desperate. When he's desperate and fits with what he wants, it's like, all right, that's think outside the box. Otherwise, think outside the box as long as it's right inside the box I've created.
Yeah. And, Wellico, we've got a last few things to talk about. Slammiversary, like, it was such a success. So, how proud of you was you of the show? Like, it was trending number one and all these things. Like, it, I've, like, because through all these dark years, I've still carried on watching Impact, because the one thing Impact Wrestling's always had, they've had a strong fan base in the UK. And I was speaking to Scott last night about it. But seeing everyone jumping on the gravy train with Impact Wrestling now and Slammiversary, I loved it. I was like, wow, I've been loyal to this, watching this company, let's support this company. Now everyone else is coming in. So how proud are you? How proud was you of Slammiversary?
It was great to have that win, man. It was great. It was great to get a win. You know, the competition is stiff, you know, with AEW showing up a year ago. Yeah. And, you know, competition is stiff. It's hard. And we needed a win. It got more buzz than anything I've been a part of since I've been there. And part of that was just the promotion of the show. We were looking at, hey, what's gonna sell this pay-per-view? And you go, well, you know, intrigue. How about that? How about what's, you know, who's gonna show up? And starting to tell those stories on TV of, you know, the matches that we know are gonna happen, but also the stuff that you don't know is gonna happen.
Yeah.
And then as it started, you know, we started to see, all right, who can we get? And we started to see the names that came in of like, all right, these guys and these guys and these guys and this guy too.
Yeah.
So we got, it was about the best case scenario as far as talent that we were able to get. And it was great, man. And it's good to have these new pieces on the board to play with and new fresh matches and just, you know, new guys and guys that are, you know, there's guys that have chips on their shoulders, you know, which happens when you leave WWE. It's like you got this chip on your shoulder and now you want to prove yourself even more. And you get guys with that sort of motivation go, yes, give me that. Perfect.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, the two guys who I popped for when I came out was the Machine Guns. Been a fan of Saban for such a long time, and Alex Shelley, which you've said you and him basically broke into the business together, pretty much. So how did you feel like seeing the Machine Guns back and your good friends? It must have been great for you.
It was great. Yeah, it's great to have them back. And Saban was working with us as a producer for a while.
That's right.
It's great to have, you know, Shelley back. And to have them kick off the pay-per-view was like, yeah. Like here, because like people are maybe expecting some of the WWE guys, right? They're expecting this guy or that guy, or hoping for this guy or that guy. But nobody saw the Machine Guns coming. It's like you start to show up with the Rascals going out there with an open challenge, and that fucking Motor City Machine come out. It's like now we're wrestling.
That's great. So last one, how exciting are you now for Bound for Glory? There's a lot of hype coming in, and some great matches. We've got the four-way tag team match, which I reckon is going to steal the show. But how excited are you for Bound for Glory?
Yeah, man, it's we're working on everything right now. How everything is gonna, you know, what things are gonna look like in the future, and it's always exciting. And you know, a lot of booking and writing is making decisions and going, all right, this is where we're hedging our money. This is where we're putting our bets. And the guys that we're putting our bets on, I feel good about. You know, like, you know, Rich Swann, you know, working with EY, you know, Rich Swann on the microphone is just, he gets me in that place that go, oh, that's from here. And I've been a big fan of Rich, and seeing him come into his own over the last year and a half or so. I remember he was doing something with Sammy Callahan. We had him like showing up. His house, and he had this promo where he's like banging on the door, like open up, sit. And I'm watching it. It's like, this is my guy here. This is a star. This is my guy. And then you have, you know, Deanna, who was a great get for us, along with Kylie Rae, who was an amazing get for us too. We have them, you know, for the Knockouts title. And you mentioned the tag team stuff. And so, yeah, man, we've got a crew of guys. You know, we lost some people over the years, that I've been there different times. You started to look at our roster. It's like, oh man, that's feeling a little bit depleted here. You know, because this is how it works. Guys come, guys go. You know, you lose Brian Cage, you lose Johnny Impact or John Morrison, you lose Penta and Phoenix, and you know, some of these guys, LAX, guys that we were really building. And so it's great to have these new guys coming in and go, great, now we have this and this, and this guy here and this here, and doing the EC3 coming in and doing the thing with him and Moose and all the, you know, the outside the box stuff there and cinematic stuff there. So it's, yeah, man, it's going to be a good show.
Cool. And right, so we're on the last segment of the show. So it's called That 90s Wrestling Podcast, because what I'm going to do now, I'm going to ask you some 90s based questions. Are you ready? Cool. So the first one, Jimmy, what's your favorite 90s movie?
Oh, geez. 90s movie. Okay. I mean, look, I really like the late 90s, early 2000s. Romantic, like teen romantic comedies,
rom-coms. Yeah,
I don't like those are right on the cusp of the 90s. But you know, something with Freddie.
She's all that. Cool. And your favorite 90s TV show?
Boy, I'm trying to think of something I watch now. I barely watch anything now, but they've got all those reruns on Netflix and stuff. I'm trying to think of stuff I grew up on, even, you know, the Full Houses of the world, and then a little later, things like ER and yeah, things like that. I mean, I don't have a great memory, but yeah. Yeah, as a kid, Full House was one that I was definitely into.
Cool. And I don't know if you're a video game player, but what was your favorite game to play in the 90s?
In the 90s? Okay, I could have given you some 80s answers on this, but... I remember when I got Final Fantasy II for my birthday, my 8th birthday. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
You look at even like Super Mario Brothers... Right, the Super Mario World was great for Super Nintendo, and I mean Mario 64 was good too. Yeah, I'm trying to, that stuff that was in. Well, I played video games. Nintendo, Super Nintendo, and
yeah,
were the ones you played. I mean, there was a lot of great ones. Castlevania Symphony of the Night was one I was really yeah. PlayStation about like 96, 97. Yeah.
Are you a fan of the anime?
No.
I've tried to get into it. I just can't get into it, but I've been playing funnily enough, I've been playing Symphony of the Night lately, so it's a quite a good game. We'll go back to 90s wrestling. Your favorite 90s wrestler growing up?
Mick Foley at the time.
Yeah. Cool. 90s tag team.
How about Rob Van Dam and Sabu? How about that?
Cool. I thought your answer was gonna be the Hardy Boys, but yeah, RVD and Sabu is a pretty good answer.
Hardy, yeah, man, Sabu and Van Dam in ECW in like 97, 98. It was like, yeah, being just really excited for their stuff back then.
Cool. And you've been a manager yourself. Your favorite 90s manager? Or your favorite manager of all time even?
Somebody asked me that the other day, this weekend.
Oh, well.
Yeah, somebody asked me who my favorite manager was. I don't know if I had a favorite manager. I mean, who is there outside of the main choices of like your Bobby Heenan's, Jimmy Hart, Jim Cornette, Paul? I mean, the stuff that Paul Heyman did, but I mean, you're talking about, you know, the stuff he did in more recent years, maybe like 5 years ago. I thought it was really good, but who else is there in the?
You got like Sherry, Miss Elizabeth, I suppose. Woman, there's been a few. Jim Cornette, it's weird. My favorite manager of all time is Bobby Heenan. It'll always be Bobby Heenan. But if I had to say 90s, I would have to say Jim Cornette because he was just so good.
Yeah, Jim Cornette was good. Yeah.
Cool. And last one, your favorite 90s match?
You know, my first favorite match was Warrior Savage, WrestleMania 7 career ending match. Yeah. So I'll go with that for now.
We'll go with that. That's a great match. And even what made it as well, like, was the aftermath when Miss Elizabeth came in. So it's one of my favorite moments as a wrestling fan ever, so I'm glad we can agree on it.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, man. I tried to recreate that. My final Ring of Honor match in 2015. Yeah. Lisa came back.
Cool. That's great. So it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Jimmy. Do you want to put your social media where people can find you?
All right. It's Jimmy Jacobs X. If you want to go on Twitter, Instagram, that's where I'm at.
Cool. Right, Jimmy, absolute pleasure talking to you. Your stories are just such great, like, talking not only to an in-ring talent, but such a creative mind behind the scenes as well, and all the little nuances, like, was like working WWE and now Impact Wrestling stuff. Just such a great conversation that I've enjoyed it so much.
Appreciate you, James.
Thank you very much. Hopefully we can do it again. Hey everyone, thanks for listening, hope you enjoyed it. Please don't forget to also head over to our YouTube channel where you can watch all our interviews in video format and catch our top 25 countdowns. And if you could like and subscribe, that'd be even better for us. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at That 90s Wrestling Podcast. Till next time, we'll see you then. Bye.